Dan, what congressional district do you live in? Senator Brenner's district, right? Good. Yeah, just kidding. Boy, that was pretty articulate, Dan. You're ready to run for office already. Well, how old are you yet? You're 20. Okay, we got a few more years. The Constitution doesn't let you run for Congress until you're 25, but that's right around the time I think Jim will move on to other things, and we got to get this guy to run for Congress, huh? That was great. Thanks, Dan. Dan did mention that I'm a big Packer fan, and there's a little haze and a funk here in Wisconsin because we're 0-4 right now. But as we like to say here in Wisconsin, we now finally know what it's like to be a Chicago Bears fan. you know, I heard a Bears fan right over here. Yeah. First of all, I want to thank you for having me here today, and thank you for having your conference here in Milwaukee. It's not very often that we have conferences like this in Milwaukee where we have, you know, enlightened, limited government advocates and conservatives, but every single time we do, always seated at the front table is Mike Grebe. Yeah. So, Mike, it's nice to see you here, too, as well. And thank you. Know, if you don't know what the Bradley Foundation does, you should really acquaint yourself with the good works that they do, because that's really the crown jewel of ideas here in Wisconsin, running contrary to the progressivism, you know, the collectivism that you've seen come from this state. I want to talk to you about a Social Security issue and what this means in the fight between individualism and collectivism, or in preserving and moving the ownership society. Now, I don't want to go through a historical rendition between the philosophical underpinnings of collectivism versus individualism. By virtue of the fact that you're in the room, you know that already. What I want to do is talk about where we are right now as a country, what this crossroad we find ourselves in, where this fork of the road is. You know, we went through the 20th century with this grand experiment in collectivism. Fighting Bob La Follette here stamped his own brand on it that we now are dealing with in many ways. We saw this experiment in one range for the other, from Soviet communism to China to the socialist, you know, quasi-socialism we have in Europe to the welfare state we've created here. Now we're coming to the beginning of the 21st century, and we are at this crossroads between these dueling ideologies, between the individual and the collectivist. And if you take a look at where we are today, I want to give you just one illustration of our present situation. I also serve on the Budget Committee, in addition to the Ways and Means Committee. The reason I ran for Congress, my primary reason for running for this job, for doing all the things you have to do to get elected, to raise all the money you have to do, is to basically fight in the battle of ideas and fight for individualism versus collectivism. That is essentially why I am in Congress. And when you want to take a look at a measurement of this fight today, consider this. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, the big three entitlements that we have today, now consume 44% of our federal budget. They will consume 100% of today's budget by the year 2035 after all of the baby boomers have retired. Because of demographics, these programs, where current workers, through their taxes, pay for current retirees, they will force the growth of government to unprecedented levels if they are not reformed. Let me describe it in another way. Over the past 30 years, our government roughly consumed about 20% of our gross domestic product. It's really largely stable. About 18.9% of our national output has been taxed from our individuals and spent on our entire federal government. According to the Congressional Budget Office, over the next 40 years, if we just keep government programs exactly as they are today, if we have no new initiatives, add no new programs, but keep government exactly as it is today, these programs will double in size, and we will have to take 40% of our gross domestic product away from our citizens to finance that federal government. The baby boomers are coming. That means we're going from a situation where we have 40 million retirees today, people over the age of 65, to 80 million retirees within one generation. We're increasing the retirement generation of this country by 100% within one generation, and only increasing the working age population, which finances their programs behind them, by 17%. So the stakes are very high. We see the current system we have right now with these pay-as-you-go systems, is what we call them, growing so much that they're going to consume as much as you see in other economies in Eastern Europe, which are running from those policies, and around the world. Now, because of this, Democrats, not all Democrats, but those who realize this and cling to their collective ideology know that time is on their side. You see, all they have to do is stop us in Congress, is to stop us in this country from transforming these programs. All they have to do is obstruct the president's ownership society agenda, stop us from reforming these entitlements, from reforming our tax code, from reforming government, because time is on their side. Their design is already built into place. It's already coming. So for if we fail right now in the House and the Senate, and with the chance the president has given us, and Democrats take back the White House, I fear it may be too late. By the end of Hillary Clinton's first term, okay, I knew I'd get some booze on that one. It's possible. By the end of her first term, nearly 15 million baby boomers will have retired already, making it so much tougher to fix the systemic problems in this. Now think of this. Right now, the baby boomers are the most dynamic force in our country. They are at the top of their game. They are the engines. They are the CEOs, the drivers, the entrepreneurs. They are the taxpayers that are really the great source of intellectual energy, economic and entrepreneurial energy right now. In 3 years, the baby boomers begin retiring for the first time. That wave of engine, of resources, of taxpayers converts over to a huge wave of tax consumers, of tax beneficiaries. And if we do not prepare government and reform these programs before they become consumers of these programs, it's going to be very difficult to reform these programs. So let's take a look at the hallmark of the New Deal. Let's take a look at the centerpiece of what people commonly refer to as the welfare state, Social Security. This is an issue that I spent a great deal of my time working on in Congress because I think it's at the center of the battle of ideas between individualism and collectivism. I serve on the Social Security Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. That is one of the main reasons why I joined the Ways and Means Committee. Think about, I want to go through just a quick history of Social Security. Remember the Great Depression. Go back in the history books, look what happened at the time. We came out of the Great Depression in 1935 with destitution. We had senior citizens who had no savings whatsoever. Everything was eviscerated. They had to go back to work to stay out of poverty. But we also had to find jobs for young people who were coming out of the Depression. So our country borrowed an idea from Otto von Bismarck, from the Germans, called pay-as-you-go, where we would tax current workers to pay for the retirement benefits of current retirees. They couldn't design a system where you would put money away for yourself, grow it over a number of years, then take it out of your retirement, like an IRA. Now, incidentally, not quite coincidentally, this system was Americanized by two professors at the University of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin plan is what is known today as the Social Security system. So we took it from von Bismarck, had a little Wisconsin tinge to it. We had two professors at Madison who really put the finishing touches on it. Now we have Social Security. Back then, the numbers added up easily. We had 42 workers paying a 2% payroll tax up to $3,000 to finance the benefits of each individual retiree. Fast forward just to 1950. We had 16 workers paying a payroll tax to finance the benefit of each individual retiree. Today, because of demographic changes, because of birth rates declining in this country and throughout the industrialized world for that matter, we have 3.3 of us, 3.3 workers paying their payroll tax benefit of 12.4% to finance the benefit of one retiree. When those boomers retire, when we double the amount of retirees in this country, increase the retirees by 100% within one generation, two workers will have to pay a payroll tax to finance the benefit of one retiree. Now, that's a demographic problem that we're facing. Now, the typical answer in Congress has always been raise tax rates. Just raise the payroll tax. We've done that 22 times in Congress. Since this program began, the payroll tax rate, not just the income limit, but the rate is raised 22 times. If we want to do this again, and I've asked the actuaries, and I get into these actuarial science discussions quite a bit with the actuaries, if we want to raise our tax rates to fix this problem, we would have to have an 18.4% payroll tax rate. We would have to raise our tax rates, our FICA taxes, by 50%. Now, consider the fact that 80% of the American worker pay more in payroll taxes than any other tax they pay at all. 80% of us pay more in payroll tax than we pay in property taxes or income taxes or any other tax. Now, there's another problem with this. And the problem is not just the math. The actuaries tell us the debt we owe to Social Security, the unfunded liability, is $11.1 trillion for the future. Meaning, today, if we wanted to set aside a chunk of money to be able to pay Social Security benefits, as they're currently defined, to everybody for the future, we'd have to put aside $11.1 trillion. Then we'd have to pay back the Social Security Trust about another $1.8 trillion. So we have roughly a $13 trillion deficit or debt we owe to Social Security to pay today's promised benefits going into the future. That's the smaller problem. The larger problem is this. It's a bad deal for workers. My mom is 70 years old, and my mom paid her FICA taxes throughout her working years. She gets about a 5% rate of return on those FICA taxes. Not a bad deal. So if you're 70, you're getting a pretty good deal to Social Security because the FICA taxes you experienced and the return you're getting right now, about 5%. For current workers today, it's an average of 1.25%. For me, at the age of 35, it's a 1% rate of return I could ever hope to get in Social Security by putting away 12.4% of my paycheck. For my three young children, all of whom are Packer fans, don't hold that against them. They are guaranteed, at best, the best possible outcome they can get in Social Security is a negative 1% rate of return on their FICA taxes. To get them that negative 1% rate of return, we'd have to come up with $4 trillion in today's dollars to pay them that benefit. So this is the problem we have today. Now, there's another great problem, and that is this. Nobody in this room has a right to their Social Security benefit. No one, not a single individual American who pays their Social Security taxes, who is supposed to get a benefit, has an individual or a contractual or a legal right to your Social Security benefit. Case after case, from Fleming versus Nestor in 1960 on, it makes it very clear. The right you have to your Social Security benefit is purely and only decided by the 535 politicians who are in Congress at any given time. None of us have any property rights or ownership over what we have from Social Security. Now, this is the system that the Democrats and the left defends. This system, which is going bankrupt, is going insolvent, gets a bad deal for people the younger they are, which we see different retirement programs from around the globe. We're the slow nation. Most other countries have already gone ahead of us in reforming their programs. This is what they're defending. Now, they say that that there's nothing to worry about, that the trust fund is fine till 2041. I want to just quickly tell you what the trust fund is. The Social Security Trust Fund, what the actuaries will tell you is, well, yeah, in 12 years we're running out of money. In 12 years when the boomers are in retirement, we don't have enough money coming in to pay benefits. That's a fact. But they then say, but the system is technically solvent until 2041. What that simply means is, we have a lot of IOUs in the Social Security Trust Fund that if we redeem those IOUs, we could extend the solvency payability of benefits until 2041. The Social Security Trust Fund is not a bank account with cash in it, with real assets in it that we can use to all of a sudden start paying benefits starting in 12 years. The Social Security Trust Fund, quite literally speaking, is a metal filing cabinet in a federal building in Parkersburg, West Virginia at the Bureau of Public Debt that just has paper in it. It basically represents an obligation to pay back money that was taken from it. It in no way represents the means to pay benefits. So the Social Security Trust Fund is not an asset to the government. It is a debt to the government. So the rubber really hits the road in this country starting in 12 years when these boomers are retiring. Now, to me, from fighting this fight now for a number of years, but especially in the Ways and Means Committee, the opponents of reform understand this issue very well. I think they understand this issue, in fact, probably better than our side does. For if workers are free to choose a personal account that they can own and control and pass on to their loved ones when they die, then they're not going to need a politician to protect their benefits when they retire. They're going to need an investment advisor. So when that happens, if we actually use personal accounts, which I'll get into in a second, to reform Social Security, there are only three ways to do it: raise taxes, cut benefits, or use personal retirement accounts. When that happens, the political party that sees itself as the party of government is no longer indispensable. I'd like to think that their opposition is a little more sincere than that, but based upon the rhetoric, I find it hard to conclude otherwise. Let me give you just one little vignette, one little story. I'd become friendly with a guy named Charlie Rangel on our committee. Charlie Rangel, as you probably know, is the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee. And I'm one of the authors of the bigger account bills. John Sununu and I have he's a senator from New Hampshire, have one of the big account bills where you can take roughly your worker portion of your Social Security tax, about 6.4% of your 12.4 percentage points to go into your personal retirement account. More about that later. And Charlie was asking me to explain to him how it works. How do you save Social Security through personal retirement accounts? As I walked him through the details of it, how it works, how you shift the benefit obligation of Social Security from the government over to a worker's personal retirement account, that worker gets a better rate of return by harnessing the power of compound interest and owns their account. It's part of their private property. It's an inheritable asset. It's a nest egg they can pass on to their heirs, and they can get better rates of return and better benefits in retirement. I was walking him through all of this stuff. He said, wait, stop right there. Hang on a second. You mean to tell me that in time with personal accounts, people will be getting their retirement benefit from their accounts and not Social Security? Well, I said, well, it'll be a Social Security personal account, but yeah. I mean, they're going to get their checks from their personal retirement account, but they'll get better benefits. They'll be guaranteed benefits. They'll be real assets. They'll actually have more money for their retirement. He said, but no, wait. You're saying that the check will come from... He kept warning about where the check comes from. He said, you mean the check comes from their account? I said, yeah, the check comes from their account. Not the government, not the Treasury Department. No. He said, well, then what would they need us for? Yeah. We can't be for that. I'm going to oppose that with everything I've got. You see, they do get it. They do understand it. They do understand the differences here. Now, consider a couple of facts. Why are personal retirement accounts good? What does it mean in this conflict between individualism and collectivism? Under the bill that John Sununu and I have, it's called the Ryan Sununu Social Security Bill. Under the current system, a 40-year-old low-wage worker who earns $20,000 a year is right now scheduled to get a monthly benefit of $1,172 when he retires. Now, that's a 40-year-old who, when he retires in 2032, is today scheduled to get a little over $1,100, provided Social Security could pay this benefit to him, of course, which it's not prepared to do so right now. Under the bill that John and I have, workers keep around half of their payroll tax for their personal accounts. That's about 6.4% on average. If this worker chooses an account and sticks with the default plan of safe index funds of 2/3 stock and 1/3 bonds over the course of his working years using historic returns, he's going to end up with more than $347,000 in his account. If you annuitize that, his monthly benefit will be $2,762. That's a benefit increase for that low-income worker of 135%. Consider a 40-year-old couple who earn each $35,000 for a total of $70,000. Two teachers who work and live right here in Wisconsin, who are halfway through working years. They're 40 years old. They earn $70,000. In our bill, in the default plan, using very conservative estimates, they're going to have nearly $830,000 in their account when they retire. Under the present system, when they retire in 2032, they're supposed to get $3,133 per month. With the personal account, their monthly benefit would be about $6,605. And when they die, their account does not go back to the government. It goes to their kids. Even if Congress just takes the first basic step. Are begun. Once these accounts take root, I believe workers are going to demand more performance. Workers are going to demand more of these accounts. You see, there's one very, very simple principle at play here. Albert Einstein said, the most powerful force in the universe is the power of compound interest. By giving individuals ownership of the fruit of their own labor, of having their own personal retirement account within Social Security, not only can you solve the solvency problem? According to our bill, which has been scored 3 times by the actuaries, it not only pays off that entire $13 trillion debt without increasing taxes or even cutting benefits for that matter, not only can you solve the financing problems with Social Security, you drastically improve the benefit for workers, but most important of all, it is their property. They own it. It is their nest egg. It goes to their heirs when they pass away. My dad died when I was 16 years old. He was 55 years old. My mom was worked at a hospital as a lab tech here in Milwaukee for a number of years, then was a stay-at-home mom. When my dad died, which was very unexpected, my mom had a decision thrust upon her at the time. Her decision was, either I get the Social Security widow benefit based upon the FICA taxes, you know, she paid when she worked, or she gets the benefit based upon the taxes my dad paid when he worked. Well, my dad worked, you know, throughout his working years. He wasn't stay-at-home like my mom, so she picked my dad's benefit. That means my mom had to give away everything she paid for all those years she worked in Social Security, just had to say goodbye to it and went back to the government. And then she had a $250 death benefit and then my dad's account. Under a personal account system, not only would my mom be able to have kept the fruit of her labor, her FICA taxes, she'd get my dad's account on top of it. You see, there are such great discrepancies, there are so many problems with the current system that penalizes women, that penalizes many people among us, that can be fixed with ownership and personal retirement accounts. Now, I like to often tell my friends on the left, and I've had this conversation with Charlie a couple of times. If your goal in society, if your goal philosophically is redistribution of wealth, if your goal is collectivism, you couldn't be any more left-wing or socialist. You couldn't come up with a better way to bridge the wealth gap and decentralize the concentration of wealth in this country than to adopt personal accounts like the ones we are proposing. According to the Social Security actuaries under our bill, within 15 years, workers will have over $7 trillion in their accounts. In 15 years, workers will have over $7 trillion in their accounts that they otherwise would not have. Every single willing worker in this country will own a large piece of their Social Security benefit and have $7 trillion in their account that they would otherwise send to Washington to go toward tax redistribution or the surplus to pay for all these other government programs. You see, with personal accounts, every worker is both a laborer and a capitalist. Every worker is an owner of our economy and our free enterprise system. And yes, if you are a stakeholder in capitalism, then you probably don't want a politician who's preaching socialism. And so, yes, to our modern liberal friends today, Social Security could be the force that closes the book on collectivism. And after all, with this kind of reform, people will be better off, which is what we should be all about here in government after all. But I believe that the other side probably understands this fight better than we do. That brings us to where we are today. How many of you think we're going to have this law passed this year? How many of you think we're going to have this law passed next year? That's the sad state of things right now. Because the boomers start retiring in 3 years. We've sent a new proposal. We're just trying to get on the floor of the House to vote on to simply dedicate the Social Security surplus to workers' accounts to begin to pre-fund workers' benefits so that we can start accounts. Now, that's the sad state of affairs right now in the current political environment we find ourselves in. The president deserves credit for bringing this idea up. He deserves credit for running on this in 2000. He deserves credit for running on it in 2004. He spent 60 days running around the country talking about this problem. My criticism of the rollout of this idea, of the fight in this idea, is I think the engineers at the White House were running the marketing department. And we did not do a good enough job of explaining the virtues of personal retirement account. We talked statistics and numbers and insolvency and doomsday and deficits and debt and problem, without telling people the virtue of ownership, of building a nest egg, of growing your money faster, of actually having something that is part of your own private property that's going to get you a better benefit. So that is where we are today. Now, that doesn't mean this is all over with. Far, far from it. It means that we have to fight this. It means that we have to move these things. We are right now in the middle of, in the House, trying to bring our bill to the floor that simply says, stop raiding the Social Security Trust Fund and spending it on all these other government programs and put it in workers' personal retirement accounts. Make them, they're totally voluntary. If you don't want to have your share of the surplus in your Social Security account, you don't have to have it. If you do, you get a tangible asset, a nest egg, a treasury bill that goes into your account to pay for your Social Security retirement benefits. We simply have to do this because if we play defense in Congress, if we play defense on these issues, then guess what? The other side will define who we are and what we stand for. The way we define ourselves, define our mission, and define our principles is we act on them. We define ourselves through our actions. And that's the fight that we have right now among ourselves, to be quite honest, in Washington. You don't win by playing defense. I keep trying to tell, you know, Mike Sherman, our head coach at the Packers, but, you know, I really don't know him, and he probably doesn't read our letters. Actually, I'm not a weirdo that writes him letters. I just want you to know that. But the point is, yeah, people are like, God, he's writing letters to Mike Sherman? Yeah, no. The point is, this fight is coming to a head. The numbers are very startling. If we do nothing, then the welfare state and these programs grow and consume us. And we will have to dedicate twice the amount of money to keep the current government going. We can fix these problems by using our principles and make people better off in the process. And at the end of the day, when you're an owner, when you're a laborer and a capitalist, when you have a real nest egg, when you make decisions for yourself and you're individually self-reliant and responsible, then you're not going to need all that government after all. And that is what this fight is all about. The sooner we on our side realize that, the sooner we move forward boldly, confidently with our ideas, the sooner we win this. So I want to just thank you for coming to Milwaukee and thank you for having me here today. Appreciate it. Yeah, that's great. Don't worry. You don't have a question.